to continue the discussion of grapefruit, one of the things the citrus industry succeeded in doing is was taking the grapefruit of our childhood, which was really sour, and now they've gentled it down where it's almost as sweet as orange juice. And some successful fruit engineering, I guess, to make it more palatable to a modern taste. P.S. Margot remembers taking cod liver oil, which I think was a standard fish oil that people took when we were children, and I suppose took it for the same reason, to provide vitamin D during the winter months. At lunch, Margot and I were talking about a statement I made on the tape this morning that I said, well, our parents probably didn't exercise, didn't engage in sports, but they worked hard. And in retrospect, I think maybe that's not true. I think the hardest work that went on in either of our families among our parents, probably scrubbing the floor once a week or whatever, if that, and that's, you know, an hour or two's hard work. And laundry day, toting wet laundry up and down stairs, and it isn't as, you know, maybe taking it out and hanging out wet to dry in the air. And again, that's some hours, but as far as really sustained hard work, first off, Marco's father had a heart condition, and he was specifically forbidden from lifting anything. And in fact, that's, I guess, what helped bring on his final fatal heart attack is he lifted an outboard motor and collapsed from that exertion. So he didn't do a lot of hard work, physical labor. And I don't think Margot's mother probably did. She wasn't lazy by a long shot, but as far as hard work, no, I don't think so. And I don't think my mother did hard work. The kind of work she did when she was employed was she worked in insurance companies like Tootsie did, and that was mostly work, clerical, accounting kinds of simple accounting things that are probably done all on computers now. A lot of hand work, sitting at a desk and writing, keeping track of this or whatever or that. My father, I don't think he was not a hardworking man that I think of. I don't have any images of him splitting wood or all day or something like that. He just wasn't. And I think the kinds of jobs he had, although I don't know a lot about that, but I think they were mainly, I don't know what you'd call them, semi-skilled blue-collar jobs, not even tradesman job like plumber or something like that, which might require more physical work. So, no, I think they didn't exercise and they didn't work hard either. Smoking. Margot's mother never smoked. It's almost inconceivable in my mind to see her mother lighting up a cigarette that she never did. Her father smoked cigars. He was a cigar smoker. Margot smoked starting quite young, maybe 15 or 16, and was a cigarette smoker well into the late 1970s, I would say. Phyllis, her sister, smoked cigarettes and may still smoke, sort of a closet smoker, you know. She'd go outside to smoke and whatever, but she was a lifetime smoker. Margot's brother, Edward, was a heavy cigarette smoker. Jim, on the other hand, never smoked. Regina, her sister, never smoked, as far as Margot can remember. I kind of had a picture of Regina's husband, Dr. Medveski, smoking cigars, but I'm not even sure of that. I would footnote that comment about Dr. Medveski. I went to see him, I don't even remember why, on a past fly-through visit in the year Cindy was born, so that would make it, what, 1953, and I was on my way to Deutschland. And one of the things he told me then, in 1953, he said, I believe that cigarette smoking will be named as a heavy in a lot of health problems. In other words, responsible for a lot of health problems. And as of the early 50s, it wasn't so identified, but he sort of predicted to me in a conversation that it would be. Now, my mother was a heavy smoker, and she smoked her whole life. I don't ever remember her not smoking. My father smoked his whole life, as far as I know. They both smoked cigarettes. My brother, Uncle Tom, he smoked cigarettes, and then, although I always thought he was more of a cigar smoker, he quit, I don't know when, but some years ago. Paula was a heavy-duty cigarette smoker, and I think she maybe quit as right after her accident, where she sort of maybe was couldn't smoke. And then I was a long-time smoker, and I'd smoke anything, cigars, pipes, cigarettes, but mainly cigarettes. And I smoked, and Malcolm and I quit cigarettes about the same time, 1978. And I had just smoked, one time I estimated something like 250 million cigarettes, some staggering number. I think, personally, not what do I know about any of this, but I think cigarette smoking is one of the most injurious common habit that that we have. I think, I've thought this for a long time, is that I think it's maybe probably more injurious than narcotics. I think if you are, one of the problems with narcotics is you have to hustle to get them and do a lot of things and hold up banks and all. But I think if a well-supplied heroin user, he's probably healthier than, or theoretically, it seems to me he's maybe healthier than a well-supplied cigarette smoker. So, and I also now think, in retrospect, of all the, first off, I think everybody admits that I was probably an incredibly wonderful father. I think that's not up even for debate or discussion, but I do think of all the things I did, I don't think I did anything worse than smoking around Sydney and County. I think this was just horrible. They grew up like I grew up, in an atmosphere where you were smoking two packs a day and you didn't even put one in your lips. It was just all the secondhand smoke and it was filled everything and it was just gross. And you know what? I know this for sure. I remember this when I was a kid. I remember my father saying something to me like, or I heard him say, I guess, maybe he didn't say it to me so much, but he said something like, well, all this advertising that, the ball players smoke cigarettes is bunk, as cigarettes shorten your wind or take your breath away or whatever. So real athletes don't smoke cigarettes, although I suppose some did. But so it wasn't that they were innocents and thought that cigarettes were harmless. I think they knew they weren't. P.S. to cigarette smoking. I must say that I don't think non-cigarette smokers have a real handle on cigarette smoking as an activity. And in fact, I'm sure they don't, because one of the funny things about cigarette smoking is you can say two things. Boy, I've got to do something really important. I've got to be up for this. I want to have a cigarette. Or a cigarette smoker at the same time can say, whoa, that was a near accident I almost had. I have to sit here and relax and have a cigarette. So it seems to be actually true that cigarette smokers use cigarettes in both ways, both to get up and to calm down. I will also say that this is absolutely true. I've said this now for years and years. I love the smoke. It was just a thing I liked to do. I didn't smoke because I was this addicted person. I enjoyed cigarettes or any kind of smoking. It was just something I liked to do. And I do remember clearly, and I'm not trying to sell smoking to anybody out. Of course, I think it's really bad for you, but I was running, jogging for an hour and still smoking a pack and a half a day or something. So what can you make of all of that? The other thing is, I have no doubt in my mind that all that cigarette smoking my mother and father did, and Uncle Ed did, and all that, that just shortened their lives. I just know it did. It was just incredibly injurious to do that, and it was dumb. I'm looking across the room to our little hutch or whatever it's called in the corner, and it's filled with wonderful glasses. There's champagne glasses, there's Bloody Mary glasses, there's, I don't know, shot glasses, cognac glasses, martini glasses, Irish crystal wine glasses. It's just filled with all kinds of really specialized glasses. I think when I grew up, I don't know that people bought glasses much. I think what they did was they bought grape jelly at the store, and when the grape jelly was finished, they washed the glass out, and that was the glass. So everybody, as far as I could kind of remember, everybody drank out of jelly glasses, is what they were called. I don't know that people went out and bought, you know, Libby glasses like we do today. It was people used the glass, jelly glasses. Another thing that came up today, or I thought about today, and was one of my memories of lunch. I don't know how often, or just a sense of how old I was when this went on or whatever, but my mother used to make creamed chipped beef. Now, chipped beef, and I went to the store today and I said, I'm going to look and see if they still even make this stuff. And I of course, forgot. But chipped beef was kind of a dry beef sort of cousin to corned beef, I guess, or something like that. Sliced extremely thin and then wrapped in a tight little ball and sold in a glass container, a little glass. And you took this out, broke it apart, this, you know, the slices, and then you made a cream sauce, and that was served over toast. Well, it's funny, Margot remembers having cream chipped beef when she was a girl. She said she hated it, but she also said, gee, I never told anybody I didn't like it. She said, I didn't think that kind of discussion was much up for grabs. You just, whatever they put in front of you, just sort of ate. But she remembers eating cream chipped beef, and I asked her, did you ever cook cream chipped beef for our kids? And she said, no, she didn't think she'd ever cook that. So we're talking about it. I have this memory of this really weird dish, cream chipped beef on dry toast, served for lunch to children, and we're talking about, what, I don't know, 55 years ago or something. And whether anybody's still poisoning their kids with this or not, I have no idea. Margot is now going to share her really contemporary, that is today's story, on a, I think, an old-fashioned word that goes back to the, 18th century. And the word is bamboozle. Now, she'll share the story with you.
I was dealing with an older gentleman in my Sheba work.
How old was he?
He told me he would be 81 on December the 6th.
Okay.
And he and I were discussing his health insurance, and he said to me that he wanted to make sure that, excuse me, this insurance that his insurance agent was talking to him about was on the up and up and not something that he didn't want to get into. And I said to him, you don't want to be bamboozled by this guy. And he said, where did you get that word? And I said, you mean bamboozled? And he said, yes. And I said, well, I'm an old lady. That's an old word, and I'm an old lady. So I said, it just came up out of my head. He said, I don't know anybody that uses that word except me. He said, you are the first person to use that word. He said, I use it all the time, and I use it when I'm playing poker with my friends. I'm always telling them that they're trying to bamboozle me. He said, I want to know where you got that word. I can't tell you. I can't tell anybody. I don't know where the word came from, but it came out of my head.
We have, incidentally, a wonderful dictionary of uncommon words and phrases and expressions and those kind of things. And it's just a treasure house of information. And sure enough, they have a bamboozle indexed in there. And Margo is now going to give you a scholarly, a separate table report on the word bamboozle.
It gives its name to our word for cheat or swindle. Probably it was an early confidence game that a female swindler posing as a bereft widow wearing black bombazine. Her costume lent its name to the swindle or hoax she and others like her practiced. Jonathan Swift included bamboozle in a list of distasteful slang words, but it survived nevertheless. Bombazine is a fabric, and it comes from the Greek word bombach for silkworm.
Please notice, unless your family eats together, you have no way of sharing this kind of information. If one person is in watching TV and eating a toasted cheese sandwich, another is on the fly going out for a hot date with a burrito in their hand, another one is worried about getting fat and hasn't had anything to eat. You never know about words like bamboozle because you never sit down and share this kind of information. Think about this. One, what did Jonathan Swift do as a profession? Two, Jonathan Swift was British, but in what city did he work? Three, name a book written by Jonathan Swift. Four, name an important essay written by Jonathan Swift. Failure to answer at least 75% of that quick quiz indicates that you do not sit down at a regular time and have supper with somebody who's really knowledgeable about all kinds of really weird stuff.
Pride goeth before a fall, Quentin.
Quick quiz number two. What is incorrect from a biblical quotation standpoint with the statement, pride goeth before a fall? I think most people believe in strange things, or they just have belief systems that they operate on. And they're often untested or not based on fact. They're often like silly even or stupid. Yet people cling to these belief systems, and I suppose believe them all their life. And not that there are some of these belief systems or beliefs don't have some, aren't maybe true, or some kernels of truth in them, but I think often they're not. As a person, there's probably no one listening to this tape or reading the transcript of this tape that has fewer weird ideas and strange beliefs and whatever than I do. I have practically none. I'm extremely rare in that case. But I would share one with you. I've believed this for a long time. I have no proof, and this is what I'm talking about, this idea. I have an idea. I have no proof of it. I can point to no evidence, but I just think it's true. And that is, I think green tea is good for you. Now, I don't know why it's good for you or even how it's good for you. I just have this idea, green tea is good for you. I think some other things that and some of these things are based on facts. And a year ago or so, or a couple of years ago, Mo and I took Cindy out, and we went to a Greek restaurant, Nico's, I think, in downtown Seattle, and had shish kebab lamb and all that stuff. It was really nice. They sold Greek wine there, and we had a bottle of Greek wine. But one of the things is they also sold Greek wine in a bottle shaped like a guitar. And I formulated a great truth then, and I want to share this, because I think it's important the older people share important truths with others. And here's the great truth. You cannot get a good glass of wine out of a bottle shaped like a guitar. In the interest of absolute historical accuracy, Margot pointed out to me that the restaurant we ate in, the Greek restaurant, was in fact in Spokane, not in Seattle. So let's correct the record, as they say. The Sunday paper has a story in it about two old a Mexican couple. They're both 92 years old, been married 66 years, and they live down in the Yakima area where so many Mexicans do live. He is in fact from that area where many of the people, the illegal and legal Mexicans from in and around Yakima live, came from. Michoacan, I guess, Michoacan. It's a province or whatever, Mexico. But one of the interesting things that this old guy did was in the 20s, he earned money, it says, by improvising soundtracks on his fiddle to accompany movies, and when they were silent movies, he was paid to, I bet not much, to play fiddle music to go along with the movies. Anyway, I was talking earlier about these gems of wisdom and belief systems that people hold. And they're quoted as saying as follows, quote, eat tamales on Christmas, but not made with pork, unquote. And I think, now what does one do with a piece of folk wisdom like that? I often don't eat tamales on Christmas, and I don't know that if I ate one, I wouldn't hesitate to eat one made with pork. Although now, here they are, 92 years old, and maybe it's a better part of valor to say, okay, I will eat tamales on Christmas that are made with pork. I would footnote this little tamale story by saying this. This is a truth. It's a cooking truth. Tamales, by definition, are made with lard. You can't make a tamale with, like, Crisco. just like you can't make a steak and kidney pie with chicken. I mean, this, if you make a tamale with something other than lard, it's not a tamale. I don't know what it is, but it's not that. And here they are, they're both born in Mexico, and they've been eating tamales probably all their life, and make it a point to do it on Christmas. And they're made with lard, and you wonder if we shouldn't tell us. They look rather healthy, actually, in the picture, this big picture of them, and smiling, and he's just laughing, and wearing a three-piece suit. But do they realize that lard is the most injurious of the fats that one can eat? Certainly next to palm oil, lard is virtually poison. Well, strange things come in triplets, I guess, and sure enough, this morning, Marla and I were discussing a Meet the Press program, which we watched early this morning while we drank our coffee and before our 1 hour and 1 minute walk. And she used the word, and the word was mollycoddle. And this is just, I was just saying, whoa, one day she says bamboozle, and the next day mollycoddle. And I looked it up, and it's based on a British slang, actually, and it means to pamper or overprotect someone, So I think if Margo will use just one more of these words, and the one I'm thinking about is Lollapalooza, if she'll use one more, I think her work is done on Earth. I think she'll have done her bit. Footnote to the Greek restaurant story in Spokane. I consider myself in some areas to be dangerously overeducated, and we saw that in the restaurant in Spokane. The menu had a pen and ink sketch of the Parthenon in Athens. The problem with the pen and ink sketch is the Parthenon, of course, is a Doric temple. And Doric temples had three steps and a foundation. So this sketch showed too many steps. So I felt obligated to point out to the waitress and get her solemn promise that she would bring it to the attention of the manager that the rendition of the Parthenon was on the menu cover was incorrect. Childhood memory, Bloomfield, New Jersey. Don't remember the year or how big I was, but I was a little guy, certainly a little guy. And as I said, Tootsie and Liza, they lived in a grand old house in the middle class neighborhood, I guess, in Bloomfield. And I loved to visit them. It was a big enough house, they had a piano. They had a piano. Nobody played that I know of. My mother, I think, took some piano lessons. They also had what now I can remember had to be either a Tiffany lamp or a facsimile of a Tiffany lamp. Probably worth thousands and thousands of dollars. I thought it was beautiful when I was a kid. No telling what you think of it now. But one of the things I remember was, and maybe only once, this only happened once, but I remember a man, an old guy, as I remember, and I would, in retrospect, think of him as an old Italian, but I'm not real sure of that, pulled around into the neighborhood, out in the street, a merry-go-round. Now, I don't know how he got this around, whether he pulled it with a horse or a pickup truck or what, I really don't remember. But this merry-go-round was no more than 12 feet wide, I wouldn't think, with little ponies on it, and the children would sit in this merry-go-round, and get this, he would hand crank this merry-go-round. He had a big crank, big iron crank, and he turned his crank, And the merry-go-round would go round and round in a circle at about, you know, 1 mile an hour, I guess. I don't know what it cost, but surely not a lot of money. You know, we're talking, I mean, I can't believe it would be more than a nickel to do this with this guy hand-cranking this. And, of course, I thought this was the greatest thing when I was, as a kid, you know, this would be wonderful to ride a real merry-go-round out in the middle of the street with some guy cranking it. And if you think about the jaded views of youngsters now, they would just think this was, I suppose, a lot of them would think it's a joke, but I thought it was a really wonderful. And one of the things Margot just pointed out and said, you may have told that story before on the tape, and we have never transcribed these tapes, so sort of we don't know how redundant we are, and maybe I did, and I don't know, and maybe we can edit some of that out at some later time. But one of the things that interests me, kind of, is that here's an old guy with a merry-go-round, mostly handmade, I suppose, you know. Certainly these couldn't have been common, and somewhere along the line this old guy decided, maybe he did it for years, I don't know. And you know, but who made this merry-go-round, and how long was it in Bloomfield? Was it only in Bloomfield, New Jersey, or did he take it to other rural places? Does anybody remember this? Are there any pictures of this? And then, somewhere along the line, either like he died or there was no more business, kids wouldn't ride the merry-go-round, some decision made not to have the merry-go-round anymore. And what happened to it? Was it thrown away in junk or scrapped during the war? Or who knows? Just interesting questions. And hard to, I mean, you'd have to just stop what you're doing, go research it, and then maybe you probably couldn't find anything out anyway. It's such an obscure thing, but nevertheless, to me, rather fascinating. One of the old things that dates, who knows, I don't know how far back, bumper cars, surely the 30s, and bumper cars are a carnival kind of thing, and Coney Island